Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anafawakin.
This week, Facebook Home, Anonymous hacks North Korea, Thunderbolt gets boltier, is Bitcoin a bust, Google Fiber rolls out to Austin, WikiLeaks wants to make a Library of Congress of secret government documents, and we say goodbye to Roger Ebert. But first, occasionally we like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. This week, I've got a couple things I wanted to talk about. I went to go see Jurassic Park, and this is the 20th anniversary 3D IMAX conversion of Jurassic Park. And I took my 8-year-old daughter, and it was her first time ever seeing Jurassic Park. And I think it held up really well. I think maybe my only complaint about it was that for the IMAX format, it wasn't originally composed for IMAX. So in some cases, Spielberg had a really sort of tight shot of extreme close-up on faces that kind of looked a little like a very extreme sort of shot to take on an IMAX screen, on 5-story screen, whatever. So, but otherwise, it looked great. I thought it was just as effective. I think just as scary. The effects, the actual CG dinosaurs, felt their age a little. But
they didn't re-render those. I thought they
No. They just kind of up-res. They did alter some effects. There's one effect that always nagged me from the very beginning. And that is in the if you're familiar with the story, obviously who isn't, but in the chase when everybody's being chased by the raptors and they hide up in the acoustic ceiling above the in the visitor center there, at one point Lexi falls out of the ceiling. And she has to scramble back up to get up into the ceiling again. And what they did was they had an adult stunt woman do that stunt and digitally pasted the actress's face onto the stunt woman. And I thought it was really super obvious, even at the time, looked like something was off because the technology just wasn't there. So they didn't necessarily change, they didn't necessarily redo that effect, but they changed the lighting a little bit so that it was a lot less noticeable and less obvious that that's a pasted on CGI effect.
But wow, they really went to the mat for this new movie. Wow. It sounds as if they were like, let's do a re-release on the cheap.
Well, you know? No, I mean,
take
I
a
think
page from Lucas's book and just redo it.
Yeah, but then you'd have people complaining about how the classic kind of look of the dinosaurs and everything weren't preserved. When you do something like that, you really have to be very, like, I think Star Trek did it right when they did the original, the effects for the original Star Trek series.
Yeah.
They redid those effects. They redid them, but they were respectful not to overdo them, to keep them still feeling in tone with the era that they were created originally.
Sure,
created.
But I just feel like, you know, the idea there is to have life-like, realistic dinosaurs, and they could have pulled that off without pissing people off. Jurassic Park is a fun movie. It's, you know, it's not a cult classic. It was widely respected. Let's call it a new classic in terms of that kind of like science fiction slash scary slash ready for everybody kind of stuff. But it's no super cult classic like the Star Wars films or Star Trek. It's a wonderful film, but it just isn't one of those. So I don't think there'll be any. I just don't think that the people are there to say, "Oh my God, it's not the same Jurassic Park because the dinosaurs aren't pixelated." Especially when it comes to digital fixes. So if it was a practical effect, and you turn that digital, you know, the campiness, all that good stuff, that's all gone.
Right.
But if it's a digital effect, just update it. You look at like Independence Day with Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum. And it's a good movie, but unfortunately some of the it's still good. The story still holds up, but unfortunately, except for the whole virus thing. Unfortunately some of the what's it called? The visual effects, they're a little dated, you know. Little tweak.
Right. Well, this was a standard sort of 3D conversion IMAX up-res. I don't think they had ever really planned to do any sort of redo of the effects, but for what it is, it held up really nicely. Sound was beautiful. This is a brief theatrical run in anticipation of re-releasing it in 3D on Blu-ray, I think later on this month, like the 23rd or so. So you should expect to see it on Blu-ray later on this month.
Mm.
Very good. Also, cool. The other thing I wanted to talk about was last week I mentioned that I had just started playing BioShock Infinite, and last night I finished playing BioShock
Infinite. How many hours did you get into it?
Well, I played it in about 4 sessions, and last night's session was the longest. I started at like 10:30, and it went to like 3 in the morning, 3 something or other in the morning. And I
so it's less than 20 hours of gameplay then.
Yeah. Overall, it's less than 20 hours of gameplay. Even with like I did a lot of sort of deep exploration, but I mean, if you're gonna qualify a game, video game by its length of play, you're missing out on the experience. And I think that what BioShock Infinite delivers experience-wise makes up for perhaps the shortness of the gameplay. And it's just an incredible experience. The ending, like, usually with movies or any sort of narrative where there's sort of a twist involved, if the twist is done right, I won't see it coming. BioShock Infinite has one of those twists that I did not see coming, and when it was revealed, I literally wept.
You did not. Wow.
I did. I had an emotional experience.
That's pretty something. That's yes. Something. Yeah. Have you played the previous BioShocks? BioShock 2.
I played the original BioShock. BioShock mm-hmm. 2 was made by a different developing game company.
Sure. Did you play it though?
I did not play it. No.
Wow.
No. And this one, I think,
this one departs, I believe, from
it does. The sort of the game mechanics are the same, and there are certain elements that are the same, and they actually address that in the game, and without giving too much away. Yeah, without giving too much away, I would say that I don't really see how there can be another entry in this franchise after this game. They kind of put the nail in the BioShock coffin on this one in a satisfying way.
Interesting. Yeah. That, very interesting.
That made you cry.
Mm-hmm.
Grown man crying.
Yeah. Doesn't happen often and rarely ever. The last video game that made me feel that way was Journey.
Wow.
Yeah,
really?
I've heard of Infinite talked with so many elevated terms that it seems like it's the must-have, not even game, but experience of the year.
I would love for one of you guys to play it also, because I'd love to talk about the ending of this game with somebody.
Which platforms is it available on?
It's available on I think on all the platforms, PS3, PC, and Xbox. I played it on the PC. I understand.
On Windows. You put it on Windows.
Yeah, I played it on Windows, yeah.
All right. Yeah, maybe I'll check it out. I've been trying to get into games on my Xbox and my PS3, but lately I just can't sit. I can't sit on the couch for that long.
Oh, this completely. And like I said, the last week when I talked about this, the thing about this game is that it completely immerses you in the environment and you become a part of that environment, and that is the kind of game that like that hits my sweet spot for video games. So this movie,
even
this
only
game
at
was
20 hours.
Yeah.
See, I like to get into it. I like to feel like, okay, for a solid month, this is my thing, and I go.
Well, yeah, and there are games like that. Like I feel like Skyrim. And both Skyrim and Red Dead Redemption were like that for me, where I feel like it's very immersive and yet extremely sort of like there's all sorts of challenges and quests and stuff. But this is more like a narrative. This is more like a less of a quest based thing and more like a narrative. You're going through a story that's being told. And from all what right, I understand, so I think like the creator, Ken Levine, Irrational Games, Ken Levine, was a little sort of felt a little hampered that he had to kind of throw in that he had to kind of fit this narrative into the sort of preconceived first person shooter notion that people had already carried over from the original BioShock and the sequel.
Like, and maybe he should have made a movie instead of
well,
a video.
Well, that's what I think. I think what I'm really looking forward to is the next property that Ken Levine tackles, the next non BioShock property that he tackles, because it'll give him an opportunity to tell a rich story like this in his own, in a way that he wants to tell it without any sort of restrictions.
I guess so, but if the restriction is that you were really successful when you made your first property, then like boo-hoo, first world problems.
yeah, it really is. So Duane, tell me about what you've been playing with this week.
Oh yeah, it's not anything really big or amazing. I think a couple weeks ago I talked about the Jobo, that was exciting, but this week I've got this toy that is really inexpensive and really awesome. It's the Fotiv 8400 mAh battery pack. It's a simple white block. It's got three holes in it, a button, and four lights. On one side is the button. You press the button, the lights show up. If you have all four lights, it's fully charged. It's a battery. And on that side is the hole with the mini USB. You plug that into the wall, and it'll charge up. It takes a while to charge up because it's 8,400 milliamps. But on the other side, it's got two ports, normal USB ports, and one of them says iPad and one of them says iPhone. Oh. And it can charge any tablet off of the iPad one, no problem. It's got enough juice in it to charge it up twice. Mm-hmm. While you're charging your tablet, you can also charge your phone or whatever from the other one. I use it most often to charge up my my MiFi. I use my MiFi pretty extensively, and if you're at like a conference or anything, you know, the MiFi could have been thicker. They could have added more battery, but they didn't. So what it does is it allows me to basically like maintain my internet connection, you know, for a very long time, or just like, you know, give my phone some juice again or whatever. It's especially helpful because there are not a lot of juice packs for the iPhone 5 out there, and that's the phone I'm using right now. So it's a little toy, but for the $12 or $15 that I spent for it on it on Amazon, it was pretty handy.
It's also seems to be like half off on at Amazon right now.
Oh, is it cheaper?
Yeah. Well, it's their list price here is their price for it is $44.95, but the list price is $99.95.
Oh wow! I did not pay $44.95 for it. I paid way less than that.
Oh well, that's great. That's even better.
I think I saw it on Ben's Bargains, actually, a while ago, and I just kind of picked it up. But I hadn't used it until really last weekend in Tahoe. I was out there skiing, and it became really helpful.
I might have to pick up one of these for Comic-Con coming up.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's definitely a little hefty. It's about three iPhone – if you take three iPhone 5s and stack them on top of each other, it's at least that tall, with a little bit of extra It's at least that thick with a little bit of extra length, a little bit extra width. But it's not completely ugly. It does fit in your bags without making a big thing. It's also shaped in such a way that it's not really going to get in the way of other stuff. So it's pretty helpful device for what it is. It's really simple. It also just goes to show how much energy we burn through with the current devices being connected all the time, playing with the cloud all day long. So I don't know. I really liked it. It was simple, Fotiv.
All right, let's get into some of our headlines this week. So as it comes as no news to anyone who's been paying attention to the news recently, North Korea has been rattling their sabers as of lately, threatening all sorts of strikes and missile tests within the last couple weeks against their neighbors and against the U.S. And apparently this rubbed Anonymous the wrong way. Because they within the last week, their official Twitter and Flickr accounts have been hacked, and two of
North Korea's official
Yes.
Twitter accounts.
North Korea.
Not anonymous.
Let's specify that. And two of North Korea's main websites defaced in an effort to disrupt the communist country's online presence. Hackers that purported to be part of the Hacktivist Collective claimed to have swiped 1,500 passwords from North Korea's Orimin-Zokiri.com news and information site in response to the North Korean regime and its nuclear weapons program. While that feat remains unclear, since the hackers posted details of just six of the accounts that they claim to have gotten, there's no doubt about the latest efforts. A pastebin note from the hackers claimed that the group has members inside North Korea who are helping with the efforts against authorities in the country. They say,
"Wow, they control Dennis Rodman."
They say they're finding their efforts thwarted by North Korean officials. The country is reported to have a 3,000 member strong cyber army and slow and unstable connections, but they are promising to, quote, inject porn and kitten images into the network as further proof of their level of access. So there you go.
Yeah. I just don't even know how I feel about that. Right? Like, okay, we think that North Korea sucks. It does. We are going to attack them with pornography. Yeah. You know, I feel like you don't really have to, if you really think North Korea sucks, and I think we can all agree that it sucks, I don't think you have to wait until they saber rattle to attack them. I'm not saying that I'm going to endorse people attacking North Korea on the cyber side. And I don't really want the U.S. embroiled in any like cyber attack situation. But if you're anonymous and you're truly international and you're all out there and you're trying to like save the world through you know, civil disobedience or online disobedience, I feel like there's really some good work to be done. You know, Iran, Iraq, you know, a whole bunch of other places where people are like really taking it. And you don't have to wait until they're in the news. I mean, obviously, if you want to get your photo op, get your 15 minutes where you can. But you can, if you think what you're doing is good work, you don't have to wait until, you know, they're being particularly more jerky than they already are, because they're pretty jerky to begin with.
I feel like Anonymous can be a sharp, dangerous, and often unfocused weapon, and I feel like when there is nothing going on in the world, that sometimes that weapon can be pointed in very sort of malicious and unproductive ways. So I'm just glad that something like this is going on in the world to give them an opportunity,
something good to do.
Yes.
Something productive.
Something
like
productive. Okay, so last week at NAB, Intel introduced the next generation of its Thunderbolt interface, which promises a data rate of 20 gigs per second in both directions on each of the two channels, as opposed to 10 gigs per second for the previous version. The next-gen Thunderbolt tech, codenamed Falcon Ridge, enables 4K video file transfer and transfer and display simultaneously, in addition to running at 20 gigs per second. It'll be backward compatible with previous gen Thunderbolt cables and connectors.
Yay!
That is, yes.
In an age of cable turmoil.
Yes.
Yay.
And production is set to ramp up in 2014.
That means it won't be available for the Mac refresh in the middle of this year.
Yes, yes. An on-stage demo with fresh off-the-press silicon showed the new Thunderbolt running at 1,200 megabytes per second, which is certainly a step up from what's currently on the market. Sounds
right.
Good to me.
I mean, when are we going to get rid of like our Ethernet-based network connections and just use some level of fiber optic-focused, you know, light peak technology, right? Like, when are we going to do that? Because why are we using, you know, that's all I'm saying. Obviously, a Thunderbolt cord at 3 feet costs $50. So that's a bit problematic.
Yeah.
But it's so much faster than gigabit Ethernet.
We have shared video data servers at my work, and we use fiber, optical fiber.
Sure. But I mean, like, the whole, like, chip at each end of the cable and all that other stuff in order to get, like, these true, you know, you can get Gbics and you can get a whole bunch of other stuff, but this is technology that works in people's houses. And I just feel like there's the, you know, given the amount of data we're moving back and forth, given the speed of our networks, a gigabit, you know, to the desktop is awesome. But at the same time, you know, I just want to know where this is going next, because, you know, it seems like we've got this amazing. It used to be that the hard drive and other transfers were the bottleneck, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, now
they're eclipsing our network speeds. There was a time when FireWire and FireWire 800 were looked at by Windows as network connections because they were so fast. And I kind of hope to see that, you know, a little bit again.
I mean, is the bottleneck right now mainly the infrastructure?
I would say so. Yeah, that's probably where it is. But inside your house, you should be able to. I'm not talking about getting it to people, you know, via the WAN. I'm just talking about inside your house, being able to hook some stuff up at those kinds of speeds.
I find that home networking probably one of the slowest evolving technologies, or at least it's the
slowest evolving part of the technology sector right now.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
Hard drives are moving faster. I guess they're not hard anymore. They're SSDs, but still. I don't know. It just gets me thinking, like, wow, I can transfer a movie that much faster.
And yeah.
That wasn't always the case. But I'm excited. I mean, who doesn't want faster connections?
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm excited too.
Yeah, as long as it's backwards compatible, because, you know, I just got the Drobo, and I don't want to have to sell it.
I love the experiences that I've had so far with my Thunderbolt connection on my Mac Air.
What do you use it for?
I use it for connecting video. Like, you know, if I've got a Thunderbolt to HDMI connector that I use to stream from my my Mac Air 2.
That shouldn't be any different than Thunderbolt to Mini DisplayPort in terms of, Mini Display to HDMI, that kind of thing.
But it works like a charm. I would love to use it. I would love to see it in a Mac Pro, in a full size Mac Pro, and that way I can run a LAN, like a, or just a bunch of discs. For editing, I think that would be a boon.
Yeah. Now they have those all the Drobos, the new ones support SSDs, so you can have multiple SSD storage rated attached to your Macintosh and get some action out of that. But yeah, I feel like there's been very little Thunderbolt adoption, to be honest.
Yeah.
Belkin came out with a pretty wonderful Thunderbolt hub. It allows you to just kind of connect your power cable to a Macintosh and your and the Thunderbolt connector, and it'll pass out it goes into the hub, and the hub has, you know, USB 3, FireWire, everything under the sun, and then it'll pass out to your monitor, right? So that's all well and good, but that device alone costs $300-something. That's a hub. So I remember FireWire always seemed expensive, but I mean, this is really, really, really genuinely expensive stuff. And I feel like between this and the Retina side of the MacBook situation, it's hard to see how Apple is going to maintain its advantage when so many other things are meant for this really expensive layout. Especially when for a while, 2007 to 2000, I feel like 10 or just before the Retinas, Apple devices seem to be on the cheap side of things, especially the iOS devices. So not the iOS devices are still where they are. They're still cheap, but the computers have definitely gotten more expensive. I'm just glad that they've kept the legacy stuff around for, you know, we people who are not ready to spend an arm and a leg.
No kidding. Okay, so Google is taking its super fast internet service, Google Fiber, to Austin, Texas, the company announced this week. The tech giant plans to start connecting homes with its gigabit internet service, which offers 1 gig broadband internet service, by the middle of 2014. It's letting its citizens choose between having the internet service or both the internet and Google Fiber TV service. While the pricing hasn't been set, the cost will be similar to the prices in Kansas City, Kansas, the company's first Google Fiber city. They're also offering a free 5 megabytes per second internet connection for 7 years for a one-time construction fee. It also plans to hook up public organizations like schools, hospitals, and community centers for free. So the second Google Fiber city has been announced, and it's Austin, Texas. I think that's a great choice because Austin is the cosmopolitan home of Texas. You know, it's the South by Southwest center of Texas. And I think it is home to the technorati in Texas. And I think it's a good sign of that they're rolling it out to some place that's not seemingly a small town like Kansas City.
I mean, Kansas City is a big place. I mean, there are two of them. That's how big it is. There's one in Missouri and there's one in Kansas.
Sure.
I feel like with Kansas City, it was saying we want to bring this New York has files. L.A. has what it's got. You know, all these places, you know, SF, they've got plenty of bandwidth too. These places have been, you know, underappreciated. They haven't had the opportunity because they haven't had the bandwidth. What happens when we give bandwidth to these people? That's an exciting prospect. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not. It's difficult for them to just go straight rural, right? So going to these cities and breaking up the markets and showing what's up. I mean, that's great and that's wonderful. So I don't know that Austin requires this in the way that, you know, other cities that are kind of on their way up, like Raleigh, North Carolina, or something like that, could use it. But hey, as long as they keep on pushing it and, you know, the other guys in the business begin to feel the pressure from individuals who really want these kinds of speeds for these no-nonsense prices that Google is laying out, then so be it. I mean, I'm happy that Austin's getting it. I feel like Austin just has so much that we could stand to open up a couple new tech spots. I'd like tech not necessarily to sit in these cloistered areas across the country, but to become ubiquitous across the nation. And if giving, you know, people access to the internet at crazy fast speeds and to enable, like, you know, data centers and shit to open up, we'll make that happen, and so be it. Who cares where?
I feel like it's, you know, like this was, like, Google had to do something like this because it's a very confident sign that their infrastructure can handle the potential load that a city like Austin will deliver.
That's a very good point. Yeah. I mean, I guess if Kansas City was a test, and Austin is opening up a new market that's bigger and stronger.
Sure.
And it paves the way toward a New York City or a San Francisco.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's they're still in testing mode, and also sort of not wanting to have to be heavily scrutinized as much as they would be, because for me, like, the first place you think they would maybe launch such things is in their own backyard in, say, Mountain View or the, you know, Tech Valley here. But, you know, as soon as that happens, they become under the microscope and everyone's going to be, you know, jumping on board.
Mm-hmm. The barrier to the management of expectations is much lower in Kansas City and Austin than it is in San Francisco. Oh, my God, exactly. I got Google. It's totally not a gigabit to the desktop. I think they're lying. You know, I'm only – here's my speed test. Here's my other speed test. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Like, exactly. So they don't have to manage the same expectations, and it's a good move for them, but I kind of wish they would come here.
I kind of wish they'd come
here. That's the thing. They got to get people wishing that they'd come here.
When they finally do make it to everybody's town, they will have disrupted the cable companies.
Finally we'll have some competition.
Yeah, I mean, if so, I mean, Google's a great company. There's no doubt about it. They've done a lot of amazing things, but they can be placed in a position that, you know, puts them in the same kind of, like, you know, I'll start over. A lot of people don't like Comcast. A lot of people don't like CenturyLink or DirecTV or any of these other people who provide TV or internet or whatever. And a lot of people just hate them because they feel like they're monopolistic and they don't like, they're not customer centric and everything. Google's in a great position to be like, hey, we're just doing this out of love and, you know, do no evil and all that stuff. But if they don't watch out, if they don't manage the people and the customer service properly, people will start turning on them too. And I would hate to see that. I think Google's done so much good. I'd hate to see them. I just hope that they're thinking about this from a customer service perspective and that they'll be able to maintain a position that allows them to, you know, always deliver the best level of service and always seems that they're in a highly competitive, you know, space instead of just becoming the de facto.
You know, the best news to come out of all of this is that they're definitely making a noticeable wave, because AT&T announced on the same day that they're building infrastructure to provide 1 gig internet service to Austin as well.
So hey, there you go.
Now the competition really starts.
Exactly. If only they can get to San Diego and sponsor Comic-Con's connectivity, right?
That would be awesome. Yeah. Glendale, though, first. Glendale, I feel, is more important. personally. Okay, so it may be the beginning of the end for the Bitcoin bubble. The price of the virtual currency, which has increased almost 20-fold this year, plunged 60% on Wednesday in the span of just 5 hours. Bitcoin prices hit a high of 266 early in the day before dropping as low as 105 in choppy afternoon trading. It later bounced back to about $145 per coin, but that's still about 45% below the high. Now, Dwayne, first of all, I mean, two questions. Is this a bubble bursting, and or is it just the market regulating itself? But first, before you answer that, please explain to me briefly, what is a Bitcoin, and how is it acquired?
A Bitcoin. I'm going to start off by saying I'm not a financial expert, but the cool thing about this is that it's both tech and finance. So we have a Bitcoin is a decentralized form of online currency, and as we discussed before the show, it's cryptographically focused. So basically, what that means is decentralized. United States, Europe, they have central banks. In the United States, we call it the Fed for short. It's the Fed. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, we have the European Central Bank. These are the places that issue the money, and these are the places that basically manage the interest rates. So when they lend money to banks, the banks then take that money at a certain interest rate, and they mark it up for businesses and consumers and the like. That's what those central banks do. That's why when we say the Fed's lowered interest rates, people are like, oh, okay. And then suddenly the interest rate on your new car, your new car loan or your mortgage is going to be lower because the bank can make money at a lower rate. The Fed does this to regulate the economy. They are focused on maintaining confidence in the U.S. dollar. That way the U.S. dollar doesn't lose too much value. And when they need to, they're going to make the interest rates go up in order to stop inflation. Things just cost a little bit more, things mm-hmm. like that. So Bitcoin is a decentralized form of currency. It only exists online, and the philosophy behind it was we've been banking with this money that's based in these countries. These countries have rash monetary policies. Who knows who's really in charge? Let's make it decentralized. Let's make cash that's decentralized, and we can do this now because of the internet. So a Bitcoin is an online form of currency. You get it from the Bitcoin guys. They run server farms, and the way you get these coins, unless you've transacted with them, maybe you bought some Bitcoins with dollars or euros or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the way they're released into the monetary system is for the Bitcoin server farm to basically create a code. And the code is not easy to break. And they're Bitcoin miners, people who sit there. And just like you'd mine gold in a mine back in 1849, they send their machines out and they try to crack this code. And the first one who cracks it gets coins. Let's say he gets 10 coins. I think it's more than that, but he gets 10 coins. And those 10 coins now were attached to the code and attached to the individual. And the system continually makes out money as quickly as people can actually mine it. So the monetary supply is growing, and it's growing through a process that involves a certain level of merit. And that's how money gets introduced into the system. And there are people who accept this form of currency. Why? Because it has all these constant things about it, so people can be confident that it's something that's going to persist and something that has value, and that continues to have value because you have to work for it. And that's really what the big thing about money. It's really about confidence. That's why when you hear about Venezuela's dollar dropping, yeah, that has a lot to do with the fact that Venezuela might have debt or something, or Hugo Chavez just died. So the confidence of the country gets lower, and thus the price, the value of the money gets lower. Bitcoin could do no wrong for a little while. As a currency, the amount of the way that people valued it, meaning the amount of dollars people were willing to give to get their hands on a Bitcoin because it was the wave of the future, this decentralized currency mm-hmm. that's basically cash. It's about me and you, Andy, and me and you, Tosin. We're doing transactions as if we had gold coins, as if we were on the gold standard. And we don't have to worry about the policy of some other group. We don't have to worry about whether or not a bank screwed up and the government wants to bail them out and charge us all more money in terms of taxes because it's completely decentralized. Problem was that it grew at a very quick pace, and we like to use the word bubble.
Yeah.
A bubble typically means that, everyone's getting confident about it until someone realizes that it's quite fake. I don't know that Bitcoin is quite fake. I think that you have to be a relative enthusiast. Let's even go as far as say you have to be an extremist to put all of your money in Bitcoin right now. Mm-hmm. You have to have supreme confidence in Bitcoin, which is an extreme thing to do, which is why I would use the term extremist. And I think there were enough people who were excited about it to see it go up. And then when it, you know, when some transactions might fall through, or there's a consensus that enough transactions aren't available to people using Bitcoin, like I can't use it to buy my groceries, I can't use it to do whatever, because, like, you know, this hotel accepts Bitcoin but this doesn't, there's some hotels that do, I think people, like, that consensus got to a point where people were like, wait, I don't think it's worth exactly what it's worth. And when that situation happens, you know, the market corrects itself. And I think that's all we can really venture to say in terms of what this online currency is valued at today versus yesterday. The fact that it bottomed out at 60% loss, that's a terrible thing for any currency to go through, right? But then it went back up. So now it's half of what it was worth. If there was a bubble, it seems to have popped, and it seems to have survived that pop somewhat. I mean, you look at, I don't know, Facebook stock. There's something else where people thought, oh, I'm so excited to get this. This is the new hotness. And then, wait a minute. I don't know how I value this. I don't know that I have real confidence in this. And the stock plummeted, right? Everybody sold it off.
This is what I thought of when I heard about this news. Is I immediately thought of Facebook stock.
Mm-hmm. And Facebook, I would say that a lot of people, I think a lot of people would say that, yes, the IPO was handled incorrectly. But despite the fact that it tripped and it fell significantly, it's found its place. And I'm not sure if Bitcoin is old enough to have found its place in terms of, like, its value. But I do know that it wouldn't have gone back up, that extra 20%, or 25% rather, if indeed, it, or I guess it was 15%, but it wouldn't have gone back up if indeed it was doomed to fail.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a lot of people, you know, during, like, the stock market crashes in the 20th century, rich people would throw all their money at stocks in a vain attempt to keep the value afloat, and it wouldn't work. Why? Because we didn't really know how stock markets work so well back in, like, the early 20th century. But it just, you know, one person doesn't have the confidence that a market does. It can't balance the confidence. So that's what's kind of gone on here. So I'm not convinced that Bitcoin is doomed, but I would say that if there was a bubble, it was severely deflated. Probably not popped, but severely deflated.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I'll be. I have not invested anything in Bitcoin yet, and I'm still on the fence about even considering it. Considering this news, and then, you know, recent news that I've heard here and there about hacks into Bitcoin markets. So
yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is ripe for cyber hardcore, you know, terrorists and so on to hop in and try to get that value. That's going to dismiss confidence, and that might keep it artificially low over time. But I would say that Bitcoin is something that's worth looking into. If you want to spend, I mean, they're very expensive right now, but they're less expensive than they were yesterday, I guess. But if you wanted to buy one and hold on to it as an experiment, I would encourage you to do so if you could afford to. Just one Bitcoin and just see how it does over time. That would be, for me as a tinkerer, you know, that's something that I'm excited to be part of and stare at.
All right. Moving on here. After a long battle with cancer, which took away his vocal cords and eventually most of his lower jaw, veteran Chicago-based film critic Roger Ebert passed away last Thursday, leaving a host of passionate film buffs mourning his loss. And while this is primarily a tech podcast, while we normally wouldn't talk about the activities of a film critic because it doesn't fall under our purview, I wanted to bring up a couple things that I felt, a couple of aspects of Roger Ebert's career that I felt are very relevant to this podcast and the tech.
He also does tie into geek culture in a big way. I mean,
exactly.
Roger Ebert, he was the guy, you know, he was a film critic. very good film critic. I think he got distilled in many ways down to this thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah.
But when you looked at the type of work that he was able to do,
when you read his reviews,
when you read his crew reviews, he was great. And he worked with Gene Siskel for a very long time, right. Until 1999 when Gene Siskel died in various forms of show or another, you know, one form of a show or another, but it was always kind of the same. Like the two of them would go back and forth about film. And they made movie criticism. They made the idea of someone kind of curating the movies that you'd see.
Sure.
Household. You got it. You understood yep. that. Yep. Okay. Yep. What are people saying about it? You look at Rotten Tomatoes today. You look at the Slash mm-hmm. Film podcast today. Those would not have happened. Those, like, you know, hallmarks of geek culture would not have happened without Siskel and Ebert kind of paving the way. Yeah. Ebert especially, even doing it after with Roper and just doing it by himself after Siskel's death.
Yep.
By just kind of household showing that, hey, this is, you know, here are the reasons. Here, I'm going to drill down into this movie and why it's good.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people spent money on this movie, but I'm going to get into, like, whether or not you'll like it. And you as this kind of watcher, or you as a family person, or you as a whatever, maybe this actress or whatever, if you like her, this is the person, this is the movie you want to watch, even though it may not be the best movie around. You know, he gave people reasons to want to see a film that were based on an opinion, which wasn't particularly agenda based, mm-hmm. except for having a good time. And I think that's something that's very difficult to do, but it has been passed on in our culture. And as he passes on, you know, I think we'll begin to, it's a good time to remember that the way we do movies and look at movies now in this kind of geeky focused Metacritic way was in part due to the way that he commodified and figured out what people would like and how they like it.
Absolutely. I mean, he was for sure one of the most, along with Gene Siskel, of course, one of the most influential film critics of our time. And personally, the one that I respected the most of all the film critics whose reviews I read.
And even the term critic is kind of like, you know, when I think we thought of critics, like, you know, back in the 80s and 70s and stuff, a critic was kind of like, oh, you know, like snooty,
right.
you know, hipster type high pants and shit right. like that. Today, you know, you look at Gene Siskel and you never thought of him as a critic, as just the movie guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
that's powerful.
He democratized film criticism, mm-hmm. For sure.
And quite the entrepreneur in that field as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
From the early days and then switching to web-based technologies and
right.
continuing to be
relevant.
Like he and Gene Siskel pioneered the idea of a show on TV that was strictly devoted to film criticism.
Mm-hmm. Meta. My content is about all this other content.
Right. Right.
Right. I mean, like that's a lot of what we do on this show. That's what the Slash Film Podcast does. That's what a lot of people do. Here's my take on this content, and here's the two of us voting about this content. And I mean, what does Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic mm-hmm, do today? Mm-hmm. They check those. They consider critics voters. Voila.
But I wanted to focus on that second part, Tosin, that you mentioned before, his sort of web presence. And it was after he was diagnosed with thyroid cancer in 2002, and he had to have a series of operations that left him unable to speak without a computer voice simulator. He poured much of his enthusiasm for life and the movies into Twitter and other social media tools, including his personal blog. In a sense, Ebert's adoption of Twitter was somewhat ironic, since social media has helped to rob traditional movie reviewers of much of their authority, to the point where many newspapers don't even employ a dedicated reviewer anymore. But for Ebert, it became a lifeline and one that only enhanced his popularity. He also came up with his own rules of how to use Twitter, which are good advice not just for journalists but for anyone. I want to read a quote from his book, from his memoirs. He said, "My blog became my voice, my outlet, my, quote, social media in a way that I couldn't have dreamed of. Into it I poured my regrets, desires, and memories. Some days I became possessed. The comments were a form of feedback I'd never had before, and I gained a better and deeper understanding of my readers. I made online friends, a concept I scoffed at. Most people choose to write a blog. I needed to." And I really felt like Ebert had an entirely new life outside of film criticism when he began becoming active in social media. I felt like I knew Ebert more as a person than I ever did in the decades earlier that I had been watching his show and reading his critiques.
That's what social media does. It turns people from icons into people, which is kind of key, right? Like, mm-hmm. Now you have the Kim Kardashians of the world, and they're always going to be an icon to someone or whatever. But that accessibility through Twitter, the ability to actually reach out and say something, they may not respond, or they may respond, but you know they got it. You know that there was a notification on whatever service they were using. You know that whoever handles that sort of thing saw it. The ability to kind of send fan mail, so to speak, or to give them a piece of your mind that quickly makes them more human, you know? Especially when you begin to see that it's not as if they can just quickly get their names, right? Like, it's usually like the real LeBron James or something like that, because they too had to suffer the fact that there was another man named LeBron James out there and yada, yada, yada. So it just makes them all that more human. And I think that I'm happy he embraced it. It's sad that it took the disease to bring him there, but it also shows that we get comfortable.
But it's amazing what he did in such a relatively short period of time. I mean, the man was already a cultural icon from the perspective of being a film critic. And he became a cultural icon independent of film criticism for just his social media efforts, which is fairly amazing. He adapted to social media and really sort of dominated it in his own way for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fairly impressive. Also, the other aspect that I wanted to talk about was he famously wrote a blog a couple years ago called Video Games Could Never Be Art, which fueled a firestorm of controversy on the internet when he posted it. He stated that he says, and I'm quoting here, "I remain convinced that in principle video games cannot be art. No video gamer now living will survive long enough to experience the medium as an art form. No one in or out of the field has ever been able to cite a game worthy of comparison with the great poets, filmmakers, novelists, and poets." He said poets twice. I don't know why he did, but that's his quote. But I remember when this came out, we discussed this on the Drill Down, and I was adamantly against that viewpoint, and still am.
Well, the fact that he can – I mean, he's lived his life defining art good, bad.
Sure, sure.
The fact that he wanted to look at the new medium and not recognize it.
Right.
It's a cliche. We've seen this before. Mm-hmm. There was a time when photography came out and people said, there's no way that could be art. It's all about the painting. There was a time when movie pictures came out and people said, there's no way that could be art. It's just, you know, whatever. There was a time when, you know, Shakespeare was doing his thing. You know, just before him, people were like, this whole playwriting, play stuff, this drama stuff, this is not art. This is like flights of fancy. It goes against the Bible. You should only be reading the Bible. Why would you go see these fake stories that aren't biblical? This is just how it is. And sure, he couldn't see, you know, so many before the medium, he didn't have the ability to see that it was what it was. I mean, we just spoke about, you know, Bioshock Infinite and how it made you weep, and Journey, which made you weep also. If art can move you to tears and video games can move you to tears, I'm not saying that one equate the correlation is causation, but just because they both do that, it means they're the same thing. But there is a case to be made that art is to be defined by the viewer. And, you know, if people who are looking at video games and being emotionally moved by video games, that's what's going on, then so be it. I mean, a game can be art, and a video can be art.
No,
put them together.
I completely agree.
There's a recipe for that.
There's a couple of issues here. I mean, first of all, you touched on it a little bit. I think absolutely, one of the things I pointed out was that at the time was that this blog post really sort of defined for most viewers that there was definitely a cultural gap in Ebert's understanding of the video game culture. And the other thing is that a lot of his opinions and viewpoints were based on very little sort of
research.
He didn't play video games frequently himself, and a lot of it was based on was in reaction to a TED talk by a video game researcher, which is linked in the article that he posted. And to make a sort of broad blanket generalization about how video games can't be art based on, you know, essentially one TED talk and very little experience in playing games, I felt was very short-sighted of him. But I love the fact that he was also like generous in allowing conflicting viewpoints to appear in his own blog by guest authors. Like, he would have guest authors come on and argue the case why Ebert is wrong on his own blog. And I thought that was very, you know, very generous of him to do that, to be open.
That's great.
To
you control the message, right? Like, yeah. you can get people out there who can talk about stuff in a negative way, but you're not making any enemies, right? They don't agree with you, but they don't have to be your enemy, which is something that I think we've forgotten a lot in the current climate. It's so easy to find your community online that people who aren't your community simply become an outsider, an enemy, that kind of thing. You don't have to just deal with people in the real world. You can escape to online. And the fact that Ebert was smart enough to say, you know what, I may not agree with this person, but I know this person loves film, or I know this person loves this subject that I'm interested in too. So why not get their voice out there? Why not have a clear and open debate? And, you know, I am Marjorie Ebert, so I'm kind of the man. But it doesn't matter. This person, this guy, this girl, they can get out there and they can say what's up and we can talk about these issues. And that's going to just make people feel more confident in me and what I do. I think if you're Ebert, you're looking at that and you're saying there's only an upside there, which is interesting because look at video games. They're actually, you know, today's video games have all the production staff that a modern film does, sometimes even more.
And budgets to boot.
The budgets, the production staff, all that stuff. You know, the budgets are bigger. The returns can be bigger.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing that, you know, maybe on some level there was something that threatened his understanding of art.
Mm-hmm.
Usually that's what happens with critics and other people who are vested in one type of platform or medium. Their conservatism has to do with the fact that they see something standing in the way of their success or possibly replacing their success. Now, a movie's going to go away, maybe one day, but no time soon. Video games are still on the rise, but I think there's a place for them both, especially now that we've seen true multimedia franchises. The game comes out with the movie, yada, yada, yada. Or the movie is based on the game, etc.
So, Roger Ebert, gonna miss him in memoriam. He was quite an influence. Let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to recommend this week, of course, has to be Roger Ebert's own memoir, Life Itself. It's narrated by Edward Herman, which most people will remember as the father from or the grandfather from Gilmore Girls and the evil vampire from Lost Boys. He's got a great sort of stentorian voice, perfect for narrating this. It's a candid personal history written by Ebert himself. He chronicles his loves, his losses, his obsessions, his struggle in recovery from alcoholism, his marriage, politics, spiritual beliefs. He talks about his years at the Sun-Times and his life-changing collaboration with Gene Siskel. He also shares his insights into movie stars and directors like John Wayne, Werner Herzog, and Martin Scorsese. It's filled with the same deep insight, dry wit, and sharp observations that his readers have long cherished. It's more than a memoir. It's a singular, warm-hearted, inspiring look at life itself. I started reading this memoir myself. Much like his reviews and much like himself in person, it's very down to earth and, what's the best way to describe it? It's plebeian. He never considered himself above the common man. And it comes through in this memoir as well. So that's Roger Ebert's Life Itself. If you don't want that book, you can have any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles to choose from. If you don't like the service, you get to keep that book for free. And to download that free audiobook, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. That's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Doing that, going to that site, helps us on the show, so give it a try. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, does Facebook finally have its long-sought phone? And why it doesn't have to be a physical device? So take a listen to this and come on back.
Now the rain turns into snowfall as the city sky reflects the silver street below. And it covers up the cars and the wallflower CD ended half an hour ago. Another fool would dig the broken car out from the snow and drive to find a show. She's gone to the movies now, and she's not coming home. She's gone to the movies now, and she's not coming home.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Onufuwakin. Last Thursday at an event at the company's campus in California, Mark Zuckerberg announced Facebook Home, a deep software integration with Android that puts Facebook services front and center. Home is a family of Facebook apps that overhauls your entire device, turning it into a Facebook phone. An app called CoverFeed overhauls the home screen and the lock screen, giving you updates on what your friends are doing without you having to launch an app or even unlock your phone, and you'll get ads in all the same places. You can comment or like posts from your home screen. Everything is full screen and incredibly visual, really looking nothing like Android. Messaging on Facebook Home is everywhere. You'll see a round icon with the face of whoever you're talking to called Chat Heads on top of any app you're using. Just tap your friend's face and up comes your chat window. There are badges and notifications on every app that lets you know when something new is happening, when someone's communicating with you. Notifications are sorted by friend rather than app. It says when your friend is doing something rather than letting you know that an app has something new for you. Instead of navigating through a list of apps, opening photos to see photos and calendars to see your events, Facebook wants to make your phone a lot more like your news feed. Home will be available beginning April 12th, but only in a limited capacity. It'll be initially available on the HTC One and One X, and Samsung Galaxy S3, S4, and Galaxy Note 2. What did you guys think about this? We briefly talked about this coming last week, and now it's actually here. What do you think about what you saw about Facebook Home, its implementation?
I mean, it certainly helped out Facebook stock, I'll tell you that. What Facebook has been able to do is what Amazon did. Take Android, do what many tinkerers call forking, which is to put your own UI on top of it.
Yeah.
And make it customized for your users, a customized experience for your users. This is sort of like when you watch the old Batman episodes and the bad guy would be taking random things from here or there, you know, maybe stealing this thing. And Batman uses the bat computer to determine what it's all going to come up to. We've seen Facebook changing things. We've seen them with the Messenger app, with the camera app. And recently, very recently, with this idea that you could voice message your friends, connect through voice via the Facebook Messenger app via voice over IP for no real money. These are all features that are going to be in this phone. These are all features that are going to allow you to interact with your phone in a better way. And now that they've solidified their relationship with iOS as an integrated partner, the experience, if you're a Facebook lover on iOS, is pretty damn awesome. And now you can have one that's even more integrated if you want. So I feel as if they've really done something that's unique. I'm not sure that it's going to completely take off, but the potential here is high if they can eventually release these handsets for free to no cost, free to low cost, you know, low cost to no cost. They can get these hands in the, they can get these phones in the hands of young people, and those people will understand that Facebook is their social lifeline, and this is the device for it. And when the advertisements do come, and they will, you know, they'll know that they have so many, you know, millions of eyeballs being able to see these advertisements, which can be completely targeted to exactly the right person at exactly the right time on exactly the right handset, wherever they are. Facebook is now in charge, not just on, but in charge of the most intimate device that you have.
Yeah, but to a certain extent, I mean, I guess it is an opt-in, but Facebook overload, it's getting to
That's
me.
That's a cultural and thing. Potentially... I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that I'm into it or whatever. I'm saying that if you get someone who's 14 years old now, and you say, okay, you're old enough to have your own Facebook account, and you know your parents said you can have a phone. Guess what? Facebook has a free phone. If you're a parent, you're like, I don't really know, but you know what? It is a free phone. Maybe there's some things I can turn off. If you're a 14-year-old, you're like, cool, I'll take the Facebook phone. It runs Android apps. It runs all these other things. And exactly. It's like integrated with Facebook. Like, this is a golden opportunity for Facebook.
Right.
And if that person will grow up with that phone. Young.
That's really true. Now, the question is, can we still – is that still possible? Is that still a direction we're heading? Because what? There are – I mean, a lot of people are – a direction that you're heading that – you can produce you can inundate youths into Facebook, but inundate from a perspective where you can
inundate
monetize
them.
I guess that's the wrong word. I guess maybe indoctrinate. Maybe that's a better
right,
word.
Right, indoctrinate. Yeah, I think you can. It's a long tail thing. When Amazon sold the Kindle, it was a loss leader, right? That's what the consensus was. They made maybe a little bit of money on it, but it really was about getting people in the ecosystem. There's no better place. There's no better ecosystem than Facebook's ecosystem, given the fact that it supports video native to Facebook. You no longer have to put a video on YouTube and connect to it on Facebook. You can just put it on Facebook. A phone allows you to share those videos directly on Facebook. Take one of your friends doing some stupid dance or some meme-based thing, and then boom, the world sees it. So it's a loss leader. You get someone who doesn't have a whole bunch of purchasing power when they're young, but you make it the best possible experience they can have. Integrated, their friends and family are all there. They can connect with them, and they're not left feeling as if they're over Facebooked or they're over exposed. Because they've grown up with this level of exposure. They've always wanted it. They've had a Facebook account since they were 9, even though it's against the rules. these people are going to allow you to, you know, you're going to be in their pocket, and those people are going to allow you, as they get older and get more purchasing power, to monetize.
You know, I want to talk about another aspect of this. Malik writes that Facebook Home should put privacy advocates on alert. For this application erodes any idea of privacy. If you install this, then it's very likely that Facebook is going to be able to track your every move and every little action. The phone's GPS can send constant information back to Facebook servers telling it your whereabouts at any time. So if your phone doesn't move from a single location between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. for, say, a week or so, Facebook can quickly deduce the location of your home. Facebook will be able to pinpoint on a map where your home is, whether you share your personal address with the site or not. It can start to build a bigger and better profile of you on its servers. It can start to correlate all of your relationships, all the places you shop, all the restaurants you dine in, and other such data. The data from its accelerometer, the accelerometer inside your phone, could tell you, it can tell Facebook servers if you're walking, running, or driving. As Zuckerberg said, unlike the iPhone or iOS, Android allows Facebook to do whatever it wants on the platform, and that means accessing the hardware as well. He goes on to say, this future is going to happen, and it's too late to debate. However, the problem is that Facebook is going to use all that data not to improve our lives, but to target better at marketing and advertising messages.
And that's where we stop, because Malik doesn't know that Facebook isn't going to use it to improve our lives. Because if Facebook has to have a bargain with the individual, especially in an age of Fitbits and other quantified self devices, the fact that they can work with you to help optimize whatever it is you're doing and still get some marketing revenue out of that, like,
why wouldn't they want to incentivize you by using the information to help make your life better? We simply don't know, and he doesn't know either. So that state, like, the whole entire thing was awesome up until that statement. But what Malik doesn't get, when he puts his own spin on that, no, they're not going to help you out. They're only going to use it for their marketers.
Well, he does go on to say,
that's not true. It's just not true. The sentence itself is too disruptive to what he to him being a regular reporter before he started throwing his opinion in on that level.
He goes on to say that it is Facebook, a company that's known to have played loose and easy with consumer privacy and data since its very inception, asking for forgiveness whenever we caught them with its hand in the cookie jar. I don't think that we can be that forgiving or reactive with Facebook on mobile. So, I mean, he's just approaching it from a potential for...
He's approaching for a potential for malfeasance, and that's fine. Facebook has a record
based on experience. Yes,
Facebook has a record. It's not even based on his experience. It has a record. It's on the record. It's empirical.
Sure,
they have fucked with people's privacy before, but
so
Facebook has also turned around in many ways.
Okay,
they've worked to determine how best to manage privacy. They've changed the way privacy settings are laid out on their website and their mobile devices multiple times. You can even be set up now to receive a text message when the privacy policy changes. You can set that up today on your phone, on your Facebook account. And I think one of the things is, you know, when someone's done something janky, we're going to remember that. It's going to be big mm-hmm. news. But there's not a lot of news that comes out when people do change the way they do things or respond. And no company has been better at responding to the outcry of people when it comes to privacy as Facebook. None.
No company is. I would argue that no company has played fast and loose with consumers' privacy as often as Facebook.
I mean, you could argue that. You could also argue that the Catholic Church is responsible for saving the most amount of lives of any organization in the world. And the Catholic religion is responsible for possibly killing more lives than any other religion in the world. So, you know, it goes both ways. What I'm saying is it's two steps forward, one step back.
Sure.
And with the phone and with the ability of what they're doing and with the movement that technology has now, like I mentioned, there is the Fitbit, the Nike Fuel Band, the Withig scale, the Wi-Fi, the Fitbit Aria scale. There are all these things that are helping people figure out what they do in their own patterns. So it's not about necessarily what you feel at the moment, but like tracking what your goal is and having the data to use that. Facebook suddenly becomes, especially in the age of Samsung Life or Samsung Health or whatever's going to be on the Galaxy S4, Facebook suddenly has the ability to step into that arena, but they know so much more about you and they have access to the whole entire device mm-hmm. that there may very well be an opportunity for them, for you, to get a lot more out of your phone through Facebook. I'm not saying I'm the biggest Facebook fan. I'm not. But I didn't like the idea that Omalik threw that snippet in there. He could have said his whole entire piece without saying, no, they're not going to help you make your life better. Because I think a lot of people would disagree and say that Facebook does make their lives better, especially if they don't live next to their loved ones or they've been separated or they're just trying to catch up with life once they get on Facebook, people that have been long lost or yada, yada, yada. So mm-hmm. the idea that Facebook doesn't want to make anyone's lives better, they just want to sell your shit to marketers, I don't buy it. Facebook worked a really long time to not have ads on its site, to not be MySpace, to remain cool by letting people communicate with one another without the push for monetization. But they're a company, they're funded, they have to make some money, they're beginning to think about that. I just think you put some perspective in there.
Sure. And lastly, before we move on to the next topic, we talked for years about Facebook having a phone, and we talked in terms of them having an actual, you know, physical device themselves. But this obviates that, doesn't that?
Well, it is a physical device they have themselves.
But I mean,
it wouldn't make sense, like developing a whole entire operating system on their own, you mean?
I mean, having an actual Facebook device of their own as opposed to bootstrapping their OS onto a pre-existing device from somebody else like HTC and Samsung.
Well, I think what we're going to see is, so for all intents and purposes, they've basically done the smart thing. They look at themselves as a platform and this is what they've done.
Sure.
They've said, okay, we're going to take some hardware. We're going to say this is the standard hardware for what we're trying to do. This is just like the Google Nexus, right? Or the Google G1, really. Mm-hmm. which is made by HTC. It's a foray. We'll see how it does. Early adopters will pick it up. Developers will mess with it. We'll see what's up. And then we'll see what we can do to offer more devices, offer a wider array of devices, do those sorts of things. So I think that it's a baby step. It's a humongous baby step. But it's baby. It's a, so it's kind of an oxymoron, but it's humongous in that they're taking this initiative, but a baby step in terms of if it works, it's a tiny movement in the right direction for what the business wants to do over time. And we still don't know what it really does want to do, but I would say that this is interesting. This, to me, is something I'm surprised that Amazon hasn't really jumped into. I mean, there was talk of an Amazon phone. I can totally see an Amazon type iPod Touch player that's tied to the pocketable, unlike the tablets, but tied to your Amazon Cloud player and all the Amazon content and applications that are available with the power of Android, all that stuff. Facebook has an opportunity to broker that kind of thing via their device. Amazon and Facebook could team up. You can maybe pay for things with pay for Amazon stuff with Facebook points, yada, yada, yada. You know, rent your videos, see that kind of stuff on there. And that would really give Apple a run for its money because those two ecosystems put together are quite powerful. So I think that it's great that they jumped in. I'm not sure what will happen. I'm not saying I completely trust Facebook. I mean, you shouldn't. But I do think that when you're looking at the situation, there's just as much opportunity for this to be awesome as there is for this to be whack.
All right. Okay, moving on here. Not long ago, WikiLeaks represented the world's most radical group of investigative journalists. Lately, Julian Assange's organization has been acting more like radical librarians. On Sunday night, WikiLeaks announced the Public Library of United States Diplomacy, or PLUS-D, an effort to digitize both secret and formerly secret documents from the U.S. diplomatic history. The group has started with a searchable archive that includes 250,000 leaked State Department memos it had previously titled Cablegate, and added to them 1.7 million files from the State Department during the 1973 to 1976 tenure of Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State. In total, the archive includes about 1 billion words. The collection covers U.S. involvements in and diplomatic and intelligence reporting on every country on Earth, WikiLeaks describes on their website. It is the single most significant body of geopolitical material ever published. The largely historical project represents a marked change for WikiLeaks, which until now has been primarily focused on publishing leaked secret material with contemporary news value. The 1970s State Department files WikiLeaks has included in PLUS-D were already declassified, and most of them previously available in the databases of National Archives and Records Agency. This is interesting because it's kind of a shift in tone for what we've come to regard WikiLeaks as representing. And it's more like they want to sort of categorize and catalog this information that had not been regularly accessible. You know, it's still public and you could still access it, but it had been sort of obfuscated, yes, by yes, by essentially by red tape and bureaucratic forms and stuff. And here it is, all in one open, searchable database.
Right. I mean, this is a place where the Wikipedia can go crazy because they can now reference stuff from a secondary perspective. Mm-hmm. Right. If you're a fanatic Wikipedia editor, you can now go and do research and then like to point to it directly. WikiLeaks has kind of, you know, they're kind of like that 80s star that's got a couple hits but no consistent following. And by putting up a site like this, you are able to basically lay out all the work that you've done. Here it is.
Yeah.
It's just here for you. And, you know, you can work with you can get some press. You can work with the journalists and say, hey, yeah, you know, I got this story. I want you to check it out before we push it out to the world or like vet this or whatever. But they have to build something in order to last longer than the time of the fad, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to be more than 15 minutes. So it makes sense in terms of saying we're a library. We've got some stuff out there. We're going to be adding more stuff to it. And we think that it'll be institutionally, helpful, right? The more this stuff is put out, whether it's legal or you know, found through nefarious means, or like, you know, it's got snuck out to us or whatever, mm-hmm. we're going to put it out there, because there are a lot of people who are spending, you know, like, you know, you watch like the Return of the Jedi, and you realize how many, like, you know, Fobbits died or whatever to get them those codes to get into the, right. Endor, right?
Many Bothans died to deliver this.
Exactly. The Bothans are killed. And the people are taking risks to get this stuff to WikiLeaks. And by building this library, this database, I feel what they're saying is that stuff is out there for everybody now. Yeah. You know, we're not going to like bury it at the bottom of the site. You can now find it, use it. And, you know, there's something to that.
As for all historians, it's good to have, you know, a centralized repository and just a lot of information on past articles. And like you said, it is a good change for WikiLeaks, where it's less like a, you know, sort of TMZ site where it's
right.
just the most relevant / most news shaking releases, and now it's a shift to also
and it was
everything
tied to this guy's personality, and this guy, like Assange, whether you like him or you hate him, he's tied to all these like scandals, sex, violence, whatever. Now this breaks away from that, so I think you hit the nail on the head.
I love this little discussion that we've had just alone for the comparisons that we've made to WikiLeaks as being like TMZ and an 80s one hit wonder. So all right, let's move on here. Our last headline before we take another brief break here. Microsoft had originally been planning to unveil its next generation Xbox details at an event in April, but The Verge has learned recently that the company has pushed this back to May. Windows watcher Paul Theriot revealed recently that Microsoft is planning an Xbox event for May 21st, and we understand this date is accurate. This is the tentative date for a next generation Xbox announcement, but Microsoft had originally planned an April 24th event. Recent rumors had focused on reports that Microsoft's next Xbox may require an always-on internet connection, a detail inadvertently confirmed by Twitter comments by Microsoft Studios creative director Adam Orth, asking why there was drama over the always-on rumors and telling people to hashtag deal with it, forcing Microsoft to issue an official apology. So, looks like the next Xbox is coming soon. And what do you think about it being an always-on internet connection? Are you going to just deal with it?
I mean, well, on the one hand, Sony was brazen enough to lay out its specs and so on. Microsoft said, oh, look at our shit. Either they were on parity with Sony or they were behind Sony. But either way, this seems to me like it could be, and this is just speculation, it could be that they were like, well, I mean, we have the buying power of Microsoft. What can we do to make it that much better, right? What can we do to really blow it out of the water? The Xbox is already so awesome. It's beating out the PS3, even though it took all these years to do it. What can we do to give an offering that really competes with this now that we know? So let's push our date back. I mean, that seems to me to be relatively conventional wisdom. When it comes to always on, I just don't know how I feel about it. I think the consoles have done a better job than the computer games when it comes to always on. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's something to be said about, okay, here, look, here's my thing. If you're going to be always on, then I don't want to buy a disc, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't want to have to buy it. If you're going to be always on, get me an app store. Let me download every game I want to play. I don't want to buy a disc.
That may come to pass. It's already kind of that way on PS3.
With PS3, you can download a whole bunch of stuff, and that's great. I guess, find, like, for instance, with a phone, you need it to not be always on. Because you're going to take your phone on an airplane. You're going to take your phone on you know, wherever. You're going to be in the subway sometimes. You want to play a game, so be it. A console is theoretically always, you know, it's at your house. It's tied into the infrastructure. Just like how your cable is always on. You know, I can see in your house that, you know, this box that sits under your thing always to be on when it comes to the internet connection. Does it suck if there's a blackout or like an internet, you know, an internet problem?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, well, at least I can play a video game. That would suck, right? If you like have an internet outage. But I don't think that happens often enough to really be a problem. The big thing is, can they service it? Is there going to be any kind? I mean, I don't know how many people are on Xbox Live at any given time, but if they sell as many of these
720s, let's call them, Xbox 720s, as they expect to? Can they really service the kind of bandwidth load that they'll need? Right? Is it only going to be good Austin question. And Kansas City with their Google internet that's going to be right. able to connect?
Look what happened to SimCity. Those servers failed, you know, the first week, and people were pissed.
Exactly. And the problem with SimCity, too, SimCity, like things on the phone or like Diablo 3, those games are played on laptops. People on laptops don't always have internet connection because they're moving their laptop around. And that, to me, is a problem. You shouldn't have to be, you know, like not many laptops are walking around with 3G connections that are easily paid for. So I feel like there is an issue there with the way that people use their tech. With the consoles, again, it's not that big an issue because it's always attached to your television, which is pretty much connected to the internet anyway if it's a smart TV. But yeah, if they have the SimCity problem, if they have the other problem, I mean, they're Microsoft, they can pretty much say whatever. But their ability to offer that always-on connection to their developers for in-game currency, you know, for all sorts of other games, I don't see them giving that up if they can help it. So many developers would love a game that's always online, that's always giving them data, it's always giving them stats, it's always returning actions and engagements and other things that are completely measurable. That's pretty tight.
Yeah, but the question is how many of those developers would actually use it? I mean,
let's look at who makes games. We have Activision, we have Blizzard, you know, EA, we have EA, Electronic Arts or whatever. Activision and Blizzard are actually tied now.
And does this help the little guys too? The indie guys?
Well, yeah, the indie guys. It's not necessarily talking about, hey, we're going to market the fuck out of this with big data. But if you're an indie guy and you know what kind of engagements your users enjoy, and you're making a game that's going to have downloadable content, or maybe it's a persistent universe, and you're always making new content for it, you begin to see what people like, and you can take that information in real time and work with it. Imagine a situation where people are swarming over some particular online good or, you know, some particular like new piece of content or like level you've put in, and you get that people are like, you know, all the people are running over to that area of your game. You can now, you know, buy more Amazon storage or whatever. You can now buy more Amazon EC2 power like right then. You can anticipate that. Because you're getting these stats in real time and you understand what's going on.
Yeah, that's a bad thing. Well, I mean, to a certain extent, getting stats in real time, that is a positive. But the question is,
always positive.
Is the enablement of being able to use the stats in real time. We already know how difficult it is currently to even get new iterations of games, you know, arcade games, new patches and fixes, which have actually pushed a lot of developers away from using the Microsoft Arcade, and the Microsoft is kind of their platform of choice. So I have a feeling that you're still going to have those similar difficulties, even if it's in an always on environment. I think the biggest issue for me, and you know, I'll say I'm an outlying case because currently, you know, I do have all the major. Well, I have two of the three major consoles. I've got a PS3, actually a couple Xbox 360s, no Wii or Wii U. But I think for me, I'm one of the few people who doesn't really see a need for a new console right now because I don't use my current consoles to their full extent. They've become more media machines. But one of the things which I really enjoyed is, you know, as you know, even though I'm in the valley, I've had cases where I've had unstable internet. And when I first moved out, you know, I didn't have service. So it was kind of enjoyable to be able to actually just sit on my couch and be able to play a game without necessitating, you know, that my Comcast service be set up day one. It was relaxing to not really have to even think about that.
There's no doubt that playing a standalone game in the quiet of your home without worrying about a notification popping up or whatever, there's no doubt that that's a great experience. I'm just saying that it's if you're going to do always on, these devices are the ones to do them on. Rather than saying, oh, you took your laptop to the park and you were going to do some LAN party shit but you can't play your game. Or you're on the plane and you suddenly can't play a game on your phone.
Right. Okay, I guess that does make sense in terms of in terms of if that's the device to leverage it. I guess the real question here is this the time to make that leap? And I think the bigger question is
think about the time. Like, Think about it. How long has the seventh generation of consoles lasted? What are we on? Almost 8 years now? 8 years, right? 05? They're thinking about the future. Whatever Xbox they release, whatever PS3 they release in 2013 or 2014 is going to be around for a long time. And if they need to put their foot down on something, it's that's functionality now, even if they can't leverage it until the future.
All right. Let's take a little break here, another little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some incredible videos hitting the web. So take a listen to this music and come on back.
People, get ready.
The robots are coming.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onufuwakin. For our final word here, we're going to take a look at a couple of our what we're calling viral videos of the week. And a couple of weeks ago, we showed you Boston Dynamics robot Big Dog outfitted with a throwing arm hurling cinder blocks strategically across the room. This week we have another example of Boston Dynamics' frighteningly ominous and lifelike robotics. It's it's their Pet Man robot, which we've showcased on the show before. But this Pet Man robot is dressed in full camo. The Pet Man robot was developed by Boston Dynamics with funding from the Department of Defense's Chemical and Biological Defense Program. It's used to test the performance of protective clothing designed for hazardous environments. And the video that we'll have link on the site shows the initial testing in a chemical protection suit and gas mask. Petman has sensors embedded in its skin that detect any chemicals leaking through the suit. The skin also maintains a microclimate inside the clothing by sweating and regulating temperature. So here we are talking about a lifelike humanoid robot that sweats and regulates temperature like a human, walking like a human. You know, this stuff creeps me out.
Leaving tissue over metal endoskeleton.
Yes, exactly. I am at once awed by the technology displayed here and frightened at the concept of this being weaponized and put in the wrong hands, or put in any hands that are against me, essentially.
Yes, so, I mean, I'm glad that we're figuring this stuff out, right?
Yeah.
That, and it's kind of like, I mean, honestly, you have like Black Hawk Down, or you have like all the people who died in Iraq, the brave men and women, and you're like, what if there were a way? I know as a sci-fi geek, I'm intentionally moving us on a path to Cylon, you know, focused like human destruction.
Right.
But if in the short term we had a conflict like this whole North Korea thing, and we could send in troops that, like the drones in the sky, you know, every time one gets blown up, the guy who's operating it like learns something and does it even better.
Yeah.
Then, and you know, he gets to, you know, go home to his mom, and you know, she's fine, or his dad or whatever. That can't be a terrible thing. Does it separate us from the kinds of conflicts that change the fate of the world in a way that's possibly less meaningful because we're not spilling blood? Maybe, but it also might be a place for, I don't know, order, less bloodshed,
I don't know. These are big questions, and I like the fact that the technology hasn't arrived, but it's so close that we can talk about it with meaning.
I said this on the last time we saw the stuff with the big dog a couple weeks ago. I am all for the development of robot technology, and I am all for the development of artificial intelligence, but I think the two of them should not be combined in any sort of way, because that way lies madness and the Terminator.
What do you mean, dude? This machine can never become alive, ever.
Oh, Robo Sparrow.
Right. So
I'm always going to bring that one up.
And that was an excellent and frightening example of that as well. All right, let's move on to our last viral video here. You get two viral videos this week for the price of one. And this one, Dwayne, you linked me to this, and I was just stunned and blown away by what I saw. Researchers at MIT have developed a computer program that reveals colors and motions in video that are otherwise invisible to the naked eye. The process is called Eulerian video magnification, and it works by homing in on specific pixels in a video over the course of time. Frame by frame, the program identifies minute changes in color and then amplifies them up to 100 times, turning, say, a subtle shift toward pink to a bright crimson. So if you're watching a video of a baby sleeping, for example, whose heartbeat would be otherwise be imperceptible, using this process would make the baby's face appear to blink crimson with each tiny heartbeat. There's an example of that in this video, plus other examples. They have a example of minute vibrations in construction equipment showing up as like cranes wobbling, and the cranes aren't actually wobbling, but you're seeing just by what it does by magnifying the video pixels.
Oh no, that's the thing. The crane is wobbling.
Yeah, the crane is wobbling, but not at a rate that we can view with our human eyes.
Exactly. So what it's showing you is the things that your eye can't really perceive. Mm-hmm. It's using what it's taking in video. It's looking at it through the computer, looking at every single chromatic change or subtle difference, and it magnifies that by showing just a bit more motion, just a bit more color once it's been like processed and rendered. So that does take some time, like Andy said. But the cool thing
is, it's giving you sight beyond sight.
Exactly, it is Lino and the Sword of Omens. That's exactly what it is.
The
Sword of
Omens
is the microprocessor that allows you to like see. That's what that whole big circle with the cat in it's for. So the cool thing here is that when you're in a building, like a tall building in LA, New York, whatever, mm-hmm. and the wind does blow, the building moves. That's in fact how the building stays aloft. If it didn't move, if it was just subject to the wind, it would crumble like the towers of old. That's what happens. It moves in order to – it sways and moves. And the cranes do the same thing. You don't really notice them, I guess, unless you're on the tippy top of them and there's not a lot of foot room or whatever, right. And like you might feel that. But that kind of swaying, that those kinds of changes, that's something that, you know, the camera will now let you see. And I mean, we were talking a little bit offline on the break, but the cool thing is, over time, this technology might, you know, it's very conceivable. This technology might be able to happen in real time, that you'll be able to have a device, not unlike Google's like imagined and perceived goggles, with this kind of technology built in, so that when you're looking at somebody, imagine a Voight-Kampff test. We're just going sci-fi all in today. imagine a Voight-Kampff test, and you know the person puts on a pair of shades like this and sees whether or not you're actually lying or you're not, or you're a replicant or skin job, whatever, because they can see in real time the types of changes that the naked eye wouldn't be able to perceive. It's the kind of stuff that we've learned from like TV shows. Like yeah. Lie to Me or The Pretender or whatever, where they can figure out these subtle cues and thus like, you know, figure out the case. That's cool. It's using science to determine things that we have perceptions of or we have hunches about, because it can actually see things that we haven't said or just enable us in sight. And this is not too different from, you know, putting on a pair of binoculars mm-hmm. and seeing things that I wasn't able to see before. It's just that now the binoculars can show you, you know, how many, you know, what the person's like heart rate is, what's moving, what's the oscillation between something, you know, it's I don't know, it's science fiction that's just like real science. That's kind of exciting to me.
Right. Well, I think the really cool thing, for those who check out the show notes, definitely make sure to watch the end of the video so that you actually see the baby, because that is really cool. Like, yeah. As you said, imagine heart monitors. Imagine, you know, now instead of having listening to the auditory pitch of your child, you just have one of these screens watching in from the baby's room and being able to monitor every action of your sleeping child or infant. Exactly. Or,
found impressive is it doesn't even matter that you don't have to be in front of a live subject to capture this with a camera. They use an example from one of the Batman movies, and it was a why am I blanking on the name of the actor in the Batman movies?
Val Kilmer?
Bale.
Christian Bale, thank you. It was a shot Kilmer, of Christian.
What, you don't like Val Kilmer as Batman?
It was a shot of Christian Bale sleeping in a scene from one of the Batman movies. They processed it through this, and you could see the heartbeat of Christian Bale captured, you know, of the actor captured on that day that they shot that scene, his actual heartbeat. And they were able to glean that just from the Blu-ray footage. I thought it was amazing.
And the actors are gonna have to become better actors,
right?
Because you know Christian Bale is sitting there pretending to sleep, but his heart's racing because he just finished some other scene. Like, it's got to slow down, or else it's not believable because his heart's moving too fast.
Well, hopefully we won't be viewing many movies through the lens of this amazing technology.
True. Well, what kind of special effects can we expect to see from this, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, we've just seen this little film. You see the baby lying there. You can understand how the blood is coursing through its veins. You understand that it's not going through some awful ordeal like SIDS or whatever, because you can see it breathing right then and right there.
Put that in 3D too, right?
Yeah. They're gonna use that in order to like figure out whether the bad guy is lying about the what's a who's it, and he's got the giga umps and yada yada yada. Like, that's gonna be a thing. Right. So there's just a lot here.
Yep,
it's cool.
The potential is staggering. All right, let's wrap this podcast up for the evening. I'm gonna go around the table here. I'm gonna start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Check me out at twitter.com/DwayneD, DWayneD. You can also check out Clip Interactive. It's the place I'm working at right now, and it's got a blog, and we've been dropping some press releases, but we're going to be dropping some interesting things about the technology and what we're going to be doing with it. So you can check that out too. And you can always check out everything I do at flavors.me/DwayneD. It's flavors.me/DWayneD.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online this week?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/toast, TOAST 4321, as well as you can find all my other podcasting work at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find my work at mrbabyman.com, twitter.com/mrbabyman, facebook.com/mrbabyman. As for the Drill Down, you can check out past episodes of our show, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network, by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. If you go to geeksofdoom.com, our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. Our show's on Stitcher. You can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices by going to stitcher.com and searching for the Drill Down. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. We've had a lot of submissions recently and published to quite a few of them, so keep it up. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.